I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, a failed politician is failing up into a $650,000 a year taxpayer-funded job to lead a failing agency. Gee, what could go wrong? Plus, Democrats find yet another tax they want to hike. Meanwhile, they also want you to pay to give immigrants hockey lessons. And the building industry blasts the ruling against I-2066 as corrupt and rigged. That and much more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support this little show of ours for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. And right now, military, veterans, and first responders can get 30% off their first year of Undivided by using the promo code USA. Hello and welcome to Undivided on this Tuesday. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback, or as I said on social media, happy Tuesday to everyone except Dow Constantine in Sound Transit. I hope you have the worst Tuesday imaginable. There are two things that have to happen and have to be true for Dow Constantine to land a $650,000 job leading a failed agency. The first thing that has to happen: people have to be very accustomed to corruption, because if people weren't accustomed to corruption, they wouldn't be this passive about it. We would literally have uprisings in the street over something like this if our electorate wasn't like perfectly fine with corruption. The second thing that has to happen is an agency like Sound Transit has to have no fear of consequences. They have to be so emboldened to do something like this that they truly believe, understand that there will be no consequence for them. And there isn't. That's the thing, is there isn't. And we talked about on the show yesterday that, you know, we have this whole set of most of the state, I would say, passive voters. They're just vote blue no matter who. It doesn't matter how corrupt you are. It doesn't matter how incompetent you are. It doesn't matter how much taxpayer money you waste. If you have a D next to your name, you're good to go. So for those who haven't followed this story, there have been rumors for several months that four-term King County Executive Dow Constantine was going to be named the new CEO of Sound Transit. It seemed like it was heading in that direction. He came out and he said that he wasn't going to run, thank God, for a fifth term. This job, you know, opening was there. And it just so happens that Dow Constantine, because he's been the King County Executive for almost 16 years, that he has appointed personally enough members of the board to have a majority in place to vote him in as the next Sound Transit CEO, which is the definition, as we've said on the show, of cronyism. And the left was outraged about this when Dow Constantine's name started to surface. I think for different reasons than I'm outraged by it, but certainly all along the spectrum, from left to right, people have been outraged by this. For the left, it was the fact that Dow Constantine has been really a failure, but Sound Transit in particular has failed in so many ways. And they're worried that the board, because they all answered to Dow Constantine, he gave them their jobs, and it's this insane cronyism, that the board won't be willing to hold him accountable for future failures. And I'm definitely worried about that too. But the way I look at this is, first of all, the cronyism is outrageous. Think about that. You set yourself up as a politician, you get the power to appoint people to the board of Sound Transit, and then it's the board members who turn around and elect the CEO of Sound Transit. So he spends 16 years setting himself up for a cushy $650,000 a year job that's going to drive his taxpayer-funded pension to about $250,000 a year. So that's all bothersome. The cronyism is obvious. It's off the charts. This is one of the biggest scandals in Seattle, King County in decades. He is absolutely incompetent. I mean, so I would have a problem with it even if he were the most qualified person for the job because of the cronyism involved. But he's not the most qualified person for the job, not even close, because he's failed in his current job as King County Executive by any sort of standard. Homelessness is worse. Crime is worse. Substance abuse is worse. He's leaving King County in a budget crisis, in a budget deficit, misspent, mismanaged. And now you're going to put him in charge of Sound Transit, which already has a long history of mismanaging money, not getting projects done on time, on budget. So you have an incompetent failure that's going to run an agency full of incompetent failures. And how do you expect that to go? So, of course, the news is that Sound Transit, despite all the backlash, has now confirmed that they are going to appoint Dow Constantine as the next CEO. They put out a statement yesterday. Sound Transit Board is scheduled to vote on the appointment of a new CEO at the full board meeting on Thursday, this Thursday. The preferred candidate is Dow Constantine, and the appointment requires a supermajority vote at a public meeting. So Dave Summers, who is the Sound Transit Board vice chair, or he's the Sound Transit Board chair, and vice chair Ryan Mello, they say, "We're pleased to put forth Dow Constantine for a vote of the board. We're confident he has the knowledge, experience, and commitment to achieve Sound Transit's goals and complete the ST3 package." How in the world could you be confident that he has the knowledge, experience, and commitment to achieve goals when he has, and I do mean this genuinely, I don't even mean it as hyperbole, he has accomplished literally nothing in 16 years, except making every major issue worse. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the only thing he's accomplished is pushing his ideological agenda onto other people. But other than that, everything else is worse. Literally, I challenge you, name something worse. And Sound Transit has been an utter failure while he's been on the board, because when you're King County executive, you get a seat on the board. And then you also get the power, of course, to appoint the board members for your for county's delegation. So he sets himself up, $650,000 a year job, and all this process playing out in secret, not a public process, only because of reporting that leaked the name of Dow Constantine, that he was their favorite, he was their shoe-in, and of course he is, because he gave more than half the board their jobs. Crazy. So Dow Constantine comes out, because the other wrinkle in this is, and maybe a little silver lining, when he takes this job, he has to leave his current job. So maybe a little silver lining for King County that he'll no longer be destroying the county as the county executive. But he put out this statement, "Remaining focused on the work we're proud to do. Dear fellow King County employee, I want to share that today the Executive Committee of the Sound Transit Board of Directors announced they are recommending that I be appointed to the position of Chief Executive Officer. The full board will consider the recommendation at its Thursday meeting. Should the board choose to appoint me, my office will be in communication to provide all relevant information on next steps. When I announced last November that I would not seek a fifth term as King County Executive, I asked our team to remain focused on our priorities and the crucial work of delivering services for the people of King County. That focus continues. Thanks to you and our 18,000 King County colleagues, we will continue throughout this year and beyond to advance our priorities, lead with our values," whose values exactly, "and focus as always on our true north, making King County a welcoming community where every person can thrive." God, this guy drives me nuts. And just that sentence there. I always hate when these politicians say our values. We don't all have the same values. I think that's very, very clear. But when he says that our true north is making King County a welcoming community, like, yeah, you focused an awful lot on that. Welcoming in your eyes, but a community where any person, every person can thrive. Yeah, tell that to the people ODing on fentanyl right now on 3rd and Pine, King County Executive Dow Constantine. Tell that to the people tucked into every nook and cranny of King County, living in tents, Dow Constantine. Tell that to the people who, because of all the taxes that you've increased, can't afford to live here anymore. Tell that to the communities where their King County Sheriff's service has been cut because of your mismanagement of the county budget over 16 years. Yeah, real bang-up job achieving your North Star of making sure the county is a place where every person can thrive. And now you get to take your brand of leadership and you get to tank Sound Transit, which is already an abysmal, corrupt, horrible agency that wastes our money. And then we have no choice. Oh, well, we're already this far putting in the new Sound Transit line, so who cares if we're $30,000 billion trillion dollars over budget? Gonna have to finish it anyway, so you guys better cough up some more money. So if that's their goal of having someone in charge who will just charge ahead with things that aren't working, way over budget, draining taxpayer funds, then I guess Dow Constantine is your guy. But it's just shocking to me. If people cared about corruption, genuinely there would be massive protests outside Dow Constantine's office today. And massive protests against Sound Transit. It's the most corrupt series of events imaginable, and so shameless that even in the face of mounting pressure and criticism over this appointment, they're like, "We're confident this is the right choice." Well, you're wrong, and you should all be ashamed of yourselves. All right, going to Olympia now. So we talked about the fact that Democrats in the Senate have introduced the largest package of tax increases in our state's history. And they're not just tax increases for the rich who should be paying their fair share. They're also including a massive increase in property taxes, really an increase that has no limit. Sky's the limit. Right now, it's capped at 1%. They want to change that and basically tie it to population growth and inflation. So all the problems people have with affording a home, they're just going to get worse and worse. And now we have another tax increase that they're putting forth. And remember what the context in which they're doing this. They spent themselves into a massive budget deficit. And now they want to reach into the pockets of working class people, steal your money to cover their ass. That's what this is all about. And they don't want to make cuts in the process. Well, we can't cut some of these critical programs. So what's the latest tax increase that they're proposing? Ah, yes. It's only a tax increase on the wealthy, Nicole. This doesn't impact anyone but the wealthy who need to pay their fair share. And that's why they're proposing an increase in the gas tax. Yeah. For as much as they complain, Democrats, oh, our tax system is so regressive. It hurts the poor and the working class. And then they push all of these increased taxes that are the definition of regressive, that take a larger percentage of income from the poor and working class than they do the wealthy. So they want to do two things. Increase the gas tax by 9 cents a gallon. So that's 9 cents in addition to the current 49.4 cents per gallon tax. And they also want to index it to inflation beginning in fiscal year 2027. So it would just continue to go up and up and up and up. And this particular policy, if they pass it, the 9 cent increase would happen right in the middle of summer, July 1st, 2025. Boop. 9% increase per gallon to their already, so bringing the total gas tax to over 49 cents a gallon, not to mention the increased costs related to the Climate Commitment Act, which is a tax. It is a gas tax. It was funny, I don't know what news agency it was, some local TV station, that said Democrats proposing, you know, the first increase to the gas tax in years. It was like, okay, no. We are experiencing an increase to the gas tax right now in principle. The Climate Commitment Act, which adds 25 cents, 30 cents, 50 cents, depending on how the climate auctions go. We've been experiencing an increase in the gas tax for some time. It's not literally the gas tax, but it is an increased tax on gas. And now they want to increase it by 9 more cents starting July 1st in the middle of all your travel holiday seasons when gas prices are already very high in Washington. They're high year round. But they're incredibly high in the summer months, of course. And then, starting in 2027, they want to make sure the fuel tax is indexed to inflation. Great. Also, there'll be a special fuel differential tax rate. So if you use special fuel, it goes even higher. 3 cents increase above the gasoline, so that it would include whatever they're adding to regular gas, special gas. 3 cent increase in the special fuel tax rate in fiscal year 2028. 3 cent increase in index to inflation beginning in 2029. So everyone's gas is going up, and that, of course, hurts the poor and the working class more. So on top of the largest package of tax increases in our state's history to try to cover the fact that they spent us into a $14 billion budget deficit, they're also looking to, as of July 1st, increase the gas tax by nine cents. So if you're keeping track on all of these things that you're going to be dealing with, the two big ones that you need to know and that you need to tell your friends and family about, property tax increases and gas tax increases, because those are two things that across political lines, voters in this state do not like. And they have said time and time again, they do not like it. They don't want increases that are massive in their property taxes without a vote of the people. They certainly don't like paying more money at the gas pump. So it's important to early and often tell people what's happening right now, what Democrats are pushing for in Olympia, the fact they're doing it in the backdrop of a $14 billion budget deficit. And they really have no interest in cutting along with this. Like, hey, we're in a bad position, so we need to cut some things that maybe aren't absolutely necessary, and then we can talk about if we're still short raising some taxes. Here's State Senator Marco Elias that, you know, we just can't have a plan where we only do cuts. That's just not acceptable.
It's focused on a couple of core principles. The first is keeping the promises we've made to Washingtonians over the last few years in investment packages, focusing on preservation and maintenance of our existing transportation system, and then focusing on the traffic safety crisis that we're still seeing play out on Washington roads. When Senator King and I started our work in January, we tried to focus first on what could we do with the resources that were in the transportation system and how far would those dollars take us. After a few weeks, it became clear that the resources in transportation are inadequate to meet the needs of Washingtonians. If we were to use our existing resources alone, it would mean significant delays to projects all over the state. It would mean suspending workforce development initiatives at ferries and state patrol, and it would mean inadequate transportation system for Washingtonians.
So that's just a nice way of saying you're SOL. We're doing this and we don't care what you think. And to be fair, Nicole was listening to the hearing, and Senator Curtis King, who's one of my state senators, seemed to be supportive of where they'd come with the transportation package. Now, the transportation package and overall budget, you know, separate, although there's a tie there, to the other budgetary issues that we're dealing with more broadly in the general fund, et cetera. But, I mean, I get it that you've spent us into such a deep hole as Democrats. Like, you have to balance the budget, so how are you going to dig yourselves out? But don't act like you're the party of the working class, you're the party of the poor, trying to lift people up, when at every turn you're introducing taxes that will push them further into poverty. That's just the truth. So they're going to focus on the bright, shiny object. Oh, but look at this. We're taxing the rich. We're taxing big businesses. It's like, fine. I mean, that's a dumb idea because it's going to trickle down and hurt people. But we're not going to let you distract from the fact that you're also pushing people out of their homes and out of the state. And you're making it harder for them to afford everyday goods because you keep driving up the price of gasoline. And meanwhile, might I just say, something we should all be able to agree on. We should only be pursuing tax cuts that hurt the working class, or tax increases rather, that hurt the working class, if you have really done everything you can to make cuts. And any Democrat who tells you that they have is lying. And you only need to look at, in the exact budget that Senate Democrats put out, in the exact budget proposal that Senate Democrats put out, where they introduced the largest package of tax increases in the history of the state of Washington, including massive property tax increases, in the exact budget, they have two line items to help teach people to play hockey. Just two examples. So one of them, $150,000 of the general fund state appropriation for fiscal year 2024 and $150,000 of the general fund state appropriation for a nonprofit that provides holistic services to help refugee and immigrant women. Funds must be used to expand an existing program that increases equity in ice skating and hockey by providing skate lessons to preschoolers from diverse and low-income families. And then another line item, $100,000 of the general fund state appropriation for fiscal year 2026 and $100,000 for the general fund state appropriation for fiscal year 2027 are provided solely for a grant to a Seattle-based nonprofit to expand a program that provides skating lessons to preschoolers from diverse and low-income families. Look, I love cute little kids. I love hockey. I love the idea of teaching cute little kids to play hockey. I love the idea of teaching immigrants to play hockey, introducing them to this awesome sport that we love in America and Canada. I love all of those ideas. I don't love the government paying for it. You don't think that you can make one call to the Seattle Kraken and say, hey, will you take over funding and supplement taxpayer funding for this program that teaches women and immigrants and kids who are from low-income communities to play hockey and learn to love the game? They would do $100,000 is nothing to the Kraken. They would do that in a second. I'm sure they're already donating to these programs. And if Democrats in the state legislature called them up and said, we're in a budget crisis, we have to be responsible with taxpayer funds, we're going to increase people's property taxes, we're going to increase the gas tax, so this is a line item that we're going to have to cut from the budget, can you help us out here? In 1 second, the Seattle Kraken would say yes. This is the difference with between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats believe that the government has to do everything and have its hands in everything. If it's a quote-unquote good program, they believe that means that the taxpayers should fund it. And that's just not the case. the taxpayers do not need to fund ice skating lessons for immigrants. So while they're all, woe is us, we can't make cuts, they have stuff like that in the existing budget that they're proposing new taxes under. And that's just one of many examples. I mean, coming up tomorrow afternoon, that reparations bill has a hearing. House Bill 1696 has a hearing tomorrow in a Senate committee. And remember what that does. If your skin is the right color, they want to gift you, no repayment, gift you a down payment to buy your first home. Those down payments would average $120,000. So during a budget crisis, they want to, for people who don't have to prove that their family members were actually discriminated against in housing, they want to expand the state's existing loan-based reparations program and make it a gift-based reparations program. And the loan-based one is already incredibly popular, where they give a zero-interest loan that you have to repay when you sell your home for a down payment. Now they just want to say you don't even have to repay it. So during a budget crisis where you're going to tax working people out of their homes, you're going to tax them out of their homes to help Black people afford a down payment on their first home? And not to mention that Black homeowners aren't excluded from having to pay into the reparations program. So you're taxing homeowners of all colors out of their homes, increasing their fees when they buy a home, so you can give a gift of $120,000 per Black first-time home buyer that they never have to repay, and you want to sit here and sell us on new taxes? You want to pay for ice skating lessons for immigrants, and you want to sell us on new taxes? You're pushing to cover sick time and legal fees for illegal immigrants, and you want to push us on new taxes? You want to fund art purchases for the poor while you try to sell us on new taxes? These people have lost their minds, but it goes back to what I said at the beginning. This situation we're in can only exist because people allow it to exist. They can only get away with doing this because the people allow them to get away with doing it. The people continue to vote for them time and time again, despite doing stuff like this, because it's vote blue no matter who, vote blue no matter how corrupt, vote blue no matter how incompetent, vote blue no matter how much cronyism is involved, vote blue no matter how much dumb shit they want to pay for with your money, vote blue no matter how expensive they make your life. Vote blue despite the fact that they're increasing taxes so high that your grandma can no longer afford to live in her home. It's insane. It's like an abusive relationship. It really is. It's an abusive relationship where they keep hurting you and hurting you and hurting you and making your life harder and harder and harder. And you keep going back for more. Not you guys, I know. Not you guys. The others. The others. Just wild stuff. All right. Speaking of wild stuff, the building industry has some harsh words when it comes to the ruling that has invalidated Initiative 2066 to protect natural gas, the head of the BIW calling it corrupt and rigged. We'll have that interview coming up. But first, I have encouraged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge. FirstMarkInsurance.com. FirstMarkInsurance.com. The main reason is it could save you a little bit of money or a lot of bit of money. We hear from undivided subscribers and listeners all the time who say they took the First Mark Challenge and they are now saving thousands of dollars on their insurance. Gosh, I heard from one viewer who says that they are saving $4,000 a year after doing the First Mark Challenge. Like, holy smokes, you know what I would buy for $4,000 a year? Nicole, what would you buy if you had an extra $4,000 a year that you had been paying toward your insurance costs and you're not anymore? I already know what I would buy.
Vacation.
Oh, of course you would. Some exotic vacation to a concert. I'd put it towards a new deck because, man, we really need a new deck.
Yeah. I mean, your deck is good, but I know what you want. You want a party deck.
Oh, it's so small. Right? That thing's old and crumbling. but the cost of wood. Anyway, firstmarkinsurance.com. It's super simple how this works. You get in touch with Firstmark. You schedule a phone call. You go over your current insurance, talk to them about your insurance needs. They go out, they shop the market totally for free, come back with their recommendations. Either they can save you money or they can't. Either they can get you better insurance or they can't. And that's it. And you make a decision from there. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you. Okay. So we talked on the show yesterday about how a King County Superior Court judge has invalidated I-2066. The judge, Sandra Whitlin, who has a long history of donating to Democratic candidates, including Jay Inslee, who was in the courtroom when she invalidated the initiative that he wanted invalidated. She ruled it's unconstitutional because she said it violates a provision that says that citizen initiatives can't include more than one subject, which is a little part that it's been used many times to invalidate initiatives that Democrats don't like, essentially. And so Greg Lane, who's the executive vice president with BIAW, they were behind with Let's Go Washington, the effort to stop the ban on natural gas. So that's what I-2066 sought to do, is maintain the ability for you to use natural gas in your home and your business. And so BIAW, obviously, builders have a lot invested in that. It's much more expensive for them to build a home and for people to have to reconfigure their homes, et cetera. So we asked Greg Lane to come on. We taped the interview with him earlier this morning. And I will tell you, he, given all the kind of behind the scenes stuff, political nature, political donations, he is quite unhappy with the ruling and how it all went down. Greg Lane, welcome back to Undivided.
It's great to be with you again, Brandy. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we got on the recording today before we started, and I was like, you look so glum. I mean, was this really, did you feel blindsided, or were you?
Well, on one hand, we weren't surprised. I mean, we knew the venue that we were in was going to be a challenge. But yeah, it was, it's the way the decision was made really was outrageous. And it really was a gut punch, I think, to all the citizens of Washington. I mean, the 550,000 people who signed the initiative, the 1.9 million that voted for it to become law. We knew that King County venue, a judge that was appointed by Jay Inslee, that, we were concerned going into it, certainly, but the way the decision was made and the reasoning behind it from the judge, I mean, it was clear this was a done deal from the get-go, it undermines, I think, the credibility of the entire system, certainly the way this is coming about, and people should be very concerned moving forward about having an initiative process that really truly is operating the way it should be, and that's a check and a balance on the legislature. And if the rest of the judicial system is going to be, I hate to use the term rigged, but set up in a way that is just going to undermine the people's right to initiative process moving forward, that should concern everybody.
Yeah, it definitely has this chilling effect, right? Because initiatives aren't cheap to run, as you know, and you guys have been involved in this one since the beginning. I do want to talk about the ruling, but just sort of that sentiment about, in this state, after 12 years of Jay Inslee, you'd be hard-pressed to find a judge that wasn't given their job by Jay Inslee.
Exactly,
but
right.
There's
yeah.
so many other layers to this that have come out. This particular judge donated to Jay Inslee's campaign for governor. Jay Inslee turned around 2 years later, appointed her to the bench. She's also donated to some other Democratic candidates who went on to not support the initiative. And on top of that, this judge just last year donated to the head of the appellate court, where I believe that this case is going to go next. So in terms of conflicts of interest, do you guys have serious concerns about that?
We do have serious concerns about it. And I think, even in the courtroom, Inslee attended the hearing, which is remarkable in itself, but I think also was a very clear indication. I compare it to the old movie, The Sting, right? Where this was a setup. And when he walked into the room, the judge clearly acknowledged him and gave him, this look like, I got you. This is a done deal. Seriously, Brandy,
Really?
that's the way, that's the way it went down. And when I was talking to our counsel, who was in the courtroom, she saw that take place and realized it's over. I mean, this was before oral arguments. This was right at the beginning. Just this head nod, like, I got you.
That's quite an accusation, Greg.
I think that's exactly what was going on there, clearly. And then if you look at the decision, the reasoning that she came up with to make the decision she did was clearly based on opposition to the policy. There was no legal basis at all to the decision that she rendered. This was set up, and I have no doubt in my mind about this. I know it sounds outrageous. It is outrageous. I am not someone to talk about it, talk in hyperbolic terms. You know
I
me.
do know
We've
that, yeah.
had many conversations, but I think the word corruption here is applicable. I not financial corruption, but in the sense of 12 years of Jay Inslee appointing judges in this state that are going to make their decisions based on policy preference and not on any sort of legal reasoning. All pretense of objectivity or impartiality was thrown out the window in this case. I mean, the judge clearly had her mind made up. Clearly, it was predetermined. And so we move forward with that being the result. We knew that, the being in the court of King County, that things were going to be a challenge for us going in anyway. But to have it set up the way that it was set up, and the outcome that we got, we didn't anticipate. And I think that's what is most outrageous about this, and should be most concerning about it to the broad to just whether you're a Republican or Democrat, right? We all want the judicial process to be impartial and to be based on the rule of law. And we have now moved into the realm where that is not the case in the vast majority of venues in this state, and that's because of Jay Inslee.
Yeah, just to underscore it for people, because we have had many conversations. I mean, when you use words like rigged and corrupt, I mean, and you say you're not a guy who engages in hyperbole, it's very true. I mean, you've texted me before when I engaged in what you considered hyperbole on my show and gave me the old tisk tisk for it. So I know you to be someone who doesn't say things like that unless he means it. I mean, like I mentioned, the connection that this judge has to, politically speaking, to the chief judge in the appellate court, is that something that you guys, I mean, what if that's the judge that you get?
Right. Well, actually, we're going to go direct review to the Supreme
You
Court,
are. Okay. But they could kick it down.
and in these cases, going direct review to the Supreme Court is justified and is really the step in the process that will be next. So we will skip the appellate court, and the attorney general, who was co-defendant in this with us, it is a bit convoluted, but because it was state law, the attorney general was the lead defendant. Right after the ruling, we were all in agreement that we were appealing directly to the Supreme Court. So we will be filing that in the next couple of weeks. We fully anticipate, as they have in the past, that they will accept it, and that we'll have a hearing in front of the Supreme Court probably late spring or early summer, sometime in May or June. So that will be the next step. So fortunately, we will avoid having to go through an appellate court, which, again, I don't think would be the best venue for us. The Supreme Court, as you know,
That's not
the
the
way
best venue
it's
either,
made up,
Greg.
right? I mean, but there are a couple things that give us some optimism and some hope at the Supreme Court. The first is that the reasoning of the judge of the decision that we got out of the Superior Court Friday is completely thrown out in terms of the Supreme Court. You go in front of the Supreme Court with a clean slate, arguing directly to the judges, and yes, we are appealing the ruling of it being unconstitutional, but the reasoning around how she got to that decision is completely irrelevant when it comes to the Supreme Court. So we're starting afresh there, which is good. The second thing is the Supreme Court will have to acknowledge and deal with court precedent, Supreme Court precedent on these cases, which is in our favor, where the Superior Court clearly did not take into that into account whatsoever. And but the Supreme Court has to. So we do feel like we will get a more fair hearing and with the Supreme Court. The other key point to, and it should have had an impact on the Superior Court level, but certainly didn't, is there is a presumption of constitutionality that has to be proven by the plaintiffs as being unconstitutional. So the judges and the Supreme Court will go in with a presumption of constitutionality that has to be disproven by the plaintiffs in them making their arguments. And I think that also will be approached more honestly, I guess, by the Supreme Court than we got in the hearing at the Superior Court level.
Well, I hope so. But you still have a court where justices, many of them owe their seat to Jay Inslee, who made initial appointments before they ended up running for their seat. So that always concerns me, especially if he's going to insert himself in person into this
we'll
process moving forward. One more thing on this, just because you brought it up, and it's actually a point I failed to make on the show yesterday. The Attorney General's office, you know, is helping to defend the initiative. I guess, and this is something I asked Nick Brown about when he was campaigning, because he was opposed to the initiatives.
Right.
And I said, well, how can people trust that you're going to defend them to the best of your ability if you don't agree with them politically? And he assured us that he would. Did you feel like through this process, the AG's office was giving the initiative the best defense it could?
We did. Okay. Yes. They worked very closely. We have an outside counsel who used to be an assistant AG that is representing us. And she knew the attorney that they've assigned, and they worked very closely together, and they did give a very aggressive defense.
Okay.
And they were as appalled, that attorney, I will say, was as appalled by the process and the decision as we were. And there was no question that they were wanting to appeal the decision and are, you know, right there in alignment with us on that. So yes, I get the skepticism. Our members have been skeptical of that as well, but we have been pleased with the defense that the AG has been giving.
Yeah.
To the
Let me end with this, Greg. You know, just broader, you represent builders. You represent the people who, you know, I think are ready to help the state deal with its lack of housing and its housing crisis and eager to do this. And there's just all these things going on. I mean, from this, which is a big slap in the face, rent control. I mean, that thing is just careening toward a signature from the governor, which is terrifying. And we've talked to other individuals about the chilling effect that would have on building in Washington state. And then you have this massive property tax increase that's being eyed by Democrats, which would increase the cost of housing for people. I mean, for your members and your builders and your industry, if all this stuff comes to fruition the way that Democrats hope it does, what is that going to mean for housing availability, for new building, et cetera?
It will reduce the ability to build affordable housing and provide home ownership opportunities for people. And that's, you know, yes, our members are concerned about it, but we are more concerned about what the policy has to the citizens of Washington, both current homeowners who, you know, now with this decision throwing out I-2066 are going to have to pay 150% increase in utility rates when they're forced to be all electric. They're going to have to pay $40,000 to $70,000 on average in conversion costs for their own homes. How many of those folks are going to be pushed out of the homes that they're in and be forced to rent again and not be able to own homes because of those costs? I think that's going to have an impact. The property tax increases are also going to have an impact on current homeowners being able to afford to stay in their homes. But it also increases the cost of new housing and provides less access then into home ownership for this younger generation or, you know, newer homeowners. And we're getting to the point, we're already to the point where only a quarter of the population can afford a mortgage on a medium price home in the state of Washington. We have the third highest medium price homes in the entire country, where are the worst in the country, number 51, even below Washington, D.C., in the number of units per capita in the country here in the state of Washington. So, I mean, we're beyond crisis point here, and they are only adding additional costs. And we tell legislators all the time, you can't make housing less expensive by making it more expensive, which is what they continue to do, right? I don't understand it. They say that they want to provide more affordable housing, home ownership opportunities for people, but yet they pass these policies that just increase the cost. And so, we're going to continue the fight. We're not giving up. We're going to appeal this decision all the way through the Supreme Court. We are actively, working against the rent control bill that's moving through the legislature and the property tax measure, trying to stand up for homeowner rights in these issues. But the numbers are challenging. They really are. We need to elect some new legislators moving forward if we're going to start turning this thing around and making progress in the other direction.
Elections have consequences. As much as we
They do.
complain about a bunch of Inslee-appointed judges, people put him in office for 12 years, and that's just it. And when we talk about these things, also, I make sure, I rail against most taxes. And my husband and I, we do fine. We don't want for anything, and we're not making big extravagant purchases. But when I think about the gas ban in particular, even though we do well and we're comfortable, I don't know how we would pay for $40,000 to $70,000 to electrify our home. So when I think about that and other gas or other tax increases, like, we'll manage. I still don't like it, but we'll manage. So this one, like, we're not on the margins at all. So I think about families that are very middle class, lower class, and it's like the people that Democrats advocate for. I'm like, there's no way they afford that. So, I mean, if I've got to figure out and make a plan ahead for how we're going to pay for it, I don't know how so much the state pays for it. So it just really makes me sick to my stomach, to be honest. All right,
I
Greg.
totally agree.
Well, for people who don't know you, this is about as fired up as you get. I've never seen Greg Lane so fired up. So it's just all sorts of stuff going on.
this one's a big one, and it's big not just because we were the sponsor of the initiative, but it's big because I've lived my entire life here in Washington State. I've worked in the legislative process my entire career, and there are certain points in that timeline, right, where there are just huge leaps that demonstrate how far left we are moving in this state. And on Friday certainly was another huge sign that things are getting worse.
Yeah, gut punch. All right, Greg Lane, keep up the good fight. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brandy.
Wild stuff. And hearing some of what was going on in the courtroom that day when Superior Court Judge Sandra Whitland decided to invalidate the voter initiative. That's pretty significant. And again, Greg Lane doesn't just throw out accusations, but him calling that ruling rigged and corrupt, suggesting that the judge and Governor Jay Inslee exchanged some sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge when Inslee walked in the room. And by any account, I mean, the political donations and appointments and all of that, how could it not give people pause about whether that ruling was rigged and corrupt? So it's insane. And the voters are the ones who lose. And, to pursue Inslee's climate agenda, trying to force a cost of $40,000 to $70,000 on families to electrify their home is utterly insane. That segment, sponsored in part by our friends at the Rental Housing Association of Washington. Become a member today if you're a landlord in the state, rhawa.org, rhawa.org. They are down there fighting tooth and nail against things like rent control, so God bless them for it. But speaking of voter initiatives being nullified, being overturned, the attack on the initiative process. Yesterday in Olympia, in the House Education Committee, there was a hearing on Senate Bill 5181. So this is the matching bill to House Bill 1296. So both the House and Senate introduced their own versions of a bill to dismantle the Parental Bill of Rights that was passed through the initiative process just last year. I want to play for you a couple cuts from the hearing yesterday. So first, Senator Claire Wilson, a Democrat who is one of the lead sponsors on Senate Bill 5189, she introduced the bill to the committee by repeating a tired lie from Democrats.
The bill doesn't change any rights.
Lie.
It protects the healthy privacy, the health privacy of students. It
Lie.
aligns definitions of health records for consistency,
Lie.
And it protects student rights that are given to them already under protecting laws and really clarifies the difference between medical record and a student record as well. I believe 5181 addresses the things we were looking for, and I appreciate you hearing the bill today.
It is an insane lie to say that Senate Bill 5181 doesn't change any rights. Then why do you need it? If it's not changing any rights from the Parental Bill of Rights, why would you need a whole new law? That seems weird. And we already know that it is. The Parental Bill of Rights did a bunch of things when it comes to the right of a parent to know what's happening with their kids at school. For instance, because of Senate Bill 5181, it's in full effect, or because of the Parental Bill of Rights, it's in full effect right now in Washington State. If your child is going to school and teachers are calling them by a different name and a different gender, you have a right to know. Before the Parental Bill of Rights, they could keep that secret from you. And I'm sure they are still keeping those secrets, violating the Parental Bill of Rights. But right now, because of the Bill of Rights, you have a right to know if your kid, Timmy's going to school and being Tammy, and everyone is calling him Tammy, her Tammy, rather. So to say, and this is not the first time we've heard a Democrat say that, oh, it doesn't change any rights, it absolutely changes rights. What the hell else was the Parental Bill of Rights for, if not to give parents more rights, and you're upending it? And I thought that State Representative Travis Couture, a Republican, had a very good question as the bill was being introduced to committee about the, there's some rules around the title of the bill and how it has to reflect the substance of the bill. And he pointed out a clear inconsistency.
The title says an act relating to amending the Parents' Rights Initiative to bring it into alignment with existing law. Well, the Parents' Rights Initiative is existing law, so how could the underlying bill actually amend it and be in order with the title?
Gee, good question.
Well, I'm not going to make any pronouncements about how a court would review that, but Representative Couture, if the title is challenged, courts do have significant experience in examining and reaching decisions on whether or not a title is appropriate or defective.
Yeah, interesting. So how can the bill bring the Parental Rights Initiative into alignment with existing law when the Parental Rights Initiative is existing law? Ah, things that make you go, hmm. I also want to give a shout out to Tim Iman. So Tim's often, you know, initiative, was a $30 card tap guy. He's often down there when it comes to testifying against efforts to undermine the initiative process. And I was just glad that someone called them out to their faces about this farce of attaching an emergency clause onto a bill like this that's clearly not an emergency, but the only reason they do it is to bypass the people's right to referendum. Here's Tim Iman's testimony.
What I'm going to talk about is the emergency clause that is slapped on this bill. Removing the parents' rights is not an emergency. Mount St. Helens blowing its top, that's an emergency. But negating a constitutional right, the right to referendum, is not an emergency. The sole motive for this emergency clause is to take away that right and force the citizens to have to do a citizen initiative instead of a referendum, which requires twice as many signatures. If you were confident that you were doing what the voters wanted, you wouldn't be fighting so hard to prevent the people from voting on it in the first place. What we've seen over and over again is this attempt, 20% of the bills have an emergency clause slapped on them. You do that in order to stop the people from having a chance to exercise a constitutional right,
yeah.
And you do it all the time. Out of 500 bills you pass every legislative session, about 100 of them you declare as an emergency. I question the motives behind this emergency clause, and I question motives when your motives are questionable. This is not even questionable.
Please do not impugn motives. Questioning our motives is also impugning.
I question the motive of the emergency clause itself. The emergency clause, it has motivated behind it to prevent the citizens from exercising a constitutional right. And if you thought you were doing the right thing, you would allow the system to go forward. Instead, the voters qualify their initiative, then you pass it for the sole purpose of being able to gut it the following session. I appreciate your consideration.
Truth bombs, and they didn't like that. Can't impugn the motives. So God forbid you sit in front of them and point out the reason they're doing these things, the reason they passed it last year just to turn around and make it easier for them to gut it this year, the reason they attach an emergency clause onto it when it's very clearly not an emergency by any definition, so they can bypass the referendum process and force people to spend more money and more time via the initiative process, which they'll just find a judge to undo, or they'll come back in the legislature and undo it themselves. It's like, we have no power. We have no power. Anyone who wants to hold the government accountable and make sure that the government has a check, we have no power. And I would also point out, this is an 80-20 issue that they're doing this on, literally. So there were 1,203 people who signed in favor of Senate Bill 5181, 4,951 people who signed in opposed. This is an 80-20 issue. People want, parents want, when the issue is explained to them factually, it's a no-brainer. Parents have a right to know what's happening with their kids at school, period. It's an 80-20 issue that Democrats are once again on the wrong side of, but they have all the power anyway because they're so dang good at lying to and gaslighting the public. All right, coming up next in our segment, Unbelievable. Oops, he did it again. Governor Inslee, another one of the individuals he granted clemency to, is back in jail. Accused of what? Dealing drugs. We'll have that coming up first. May is going to be a great month of the year to sell your home. So if you've been thinking about it and you're pretty close to that stage, reach out today to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. He can help you make sure that your home is properly prepared for sale. That's the big thing. But there's a lot that goes into that. Is it priced correctly? That's huge. And Wes has been doing this for a long time. He knows the market. He knows how it works. He's going to know the right price to list your home at to make sure you get the best possible offers. And then is it properly prepared for listing? I mean, look, this is a seller's market. There is a ton of pent-up buyer demand. So if you list your home, like, it's going to do well, right? But you want to make sure that it exceeds your expectations. And so if there need to be some cosmetic upgrades that are made, Wes and his team can totally take that off your hands. They can manage those projects for you. In fact, Wes loves to do that. He's the son of a builder. And you don't even have to pay for it until closing, which is nice if you're kind of worried about coming out of pocket for cosmetic upgrades, etc. So reach out to our friend Wes Jones. He says 2025 is shaping up to be a great year for real estate. Sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com, simply a better way to sell your home. All right, ladies and gentlemen, 69-year-old Eugene Smith was just released from prison back in 2021, courtesy of former Governor Jay Inslee, but it already looks like he's heading back to the slammer. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Oop. All right, second time in a week that someone who Governor Jay Inslee granted clemency to as he left office has been rearrested on drug charges. This arrest came from the Snohomish Regional Drug Task Force. Our friend David Rose over at Fox 13 reporting on it. And even David says, here we go again. It's like one of the only honest members of legacy media left. Just love David. Here we go again. 69-year-old Eugene Smith was released from prison in 2021 when Governor Inslee commuted his sentence for robbery and assault. Now he's back in jail. The Snohomish County Regional Drug Task Force arrested him on Friday, bail set at $100,000. And there were a ton of these commutations that Governor Inslee put down for people who had a variety of criminal convictions. Like in this case, it was robbery and assault, but whose offender score had been raised by a conviction for a felony drug possession. So when the Supreme Court nullified our state's felony drug possession statute in the Blake decision, essentially there were offenders who had to be sort of, their offender score had to be tweaked a little bit because of that decision. Then Jay Inslee went and he took it a step further and he said, you know what, let's let a bunch of them out of prison. Because so what if they had a felony drug possession, you know, 10, 15 years ago? That's a, you know, that's not a big deal. And so they shouldn't still be in prison for robbery and assault. So, of course, this comes after what was a huge story across the entire country in that someone who Governor Jay Inslee gave clemency to, this was last week this news came out, right? Percy Levy, a guy who went on after Jay Inslee released him, like took a bunch of pictures of Jay Inslee. Thanks, man. Thanks for this. Ends up getting rearrested for drug trafficking and illegal firearm possession. Had enough fentanyl to kill 250,000 people. And I think one of the other wrinkles of this is that Percy Levy, once he got out, he went on to be this advocate for criminal justice reform. I mean, he literally was testifying on behalf of a pro-crime bill in Olympia hours before the drug task force arrested him. Hours. And he was buddy-buddy with Rep. Tara Simmons, soft on crime. I mean, he was being held up as this example of what can, you know, why giving people a second chance is great. And you can just turn your life around. And he was operating this auto dealership, what was that called, Second Chance Auto or something like that, where it was like he was really leaning on his, Redemption Auto. Yeah. It's a redemption story, right? All the while he's slinging deadly drugs on the streets, right? So it's just insane. So, and I also give credit to David Rose for this. So I just wanted to note, guess who's out of jail? So Percy Levy, the bail that was set for him in that case was appropriate. It was $1.5 million because the judge was so taken aback by the amount of fentanyl that he had. And again, any dose of fentanyl can kill someone. So he had enough fentanyl to kill 250,000 people. And the judge is like, that's a lot of fentanyl. And of course, he has these past criminal convictions. So his bail was set at $1.5 million, which carry the two, add the four, divide by six, square root of, that would mean that he needed to present $150,000 cash to a bail bondsman and prove he had $1.5 million in assets. How could someone who has spent almost his entire adult life in prison just getting a commutation to get out from Governor Inslee put forth $150,000 cash, sacrifice it, because that's what you pay the bail bondsman, and prove they have $1.5 million in assets? Where'd that money come from? I mean, look, maybe he's independently wealthy, or he's got a rich family member or something. I guess that's possible. Could it be money from dealing fentanyl? Could it be money from drug trafficking? Or other ill-gotten gains? Seems like quite a possibility, doesn't it? Have they tracked down all his money, all his funds, how he's paid for things? Whether he was using his car dealership as a money laundering front for his drug trafficking? Shouldn't you tie up all those resources? Yeah, so guy who just gets sprung from prison after spending the majority of his adult life in prison is able to put up $150,000 cash to a bail bondsman and prove he has $1.5 million in assets. Something's not right there. I wonder if the little woke organization that bails out criminals if they're the right skin color. What is
Northwest Bail Fund?
Yeah, I wonder are they still operating? Do the Northwest Bail Fund bail them out? No, I'm sorry. If you're trafficking that much drugs, you're probably making pretty good money. There's a reason people do it. Interesting. So we'll just wait for the next example of somebody Governor Jay Inslee let out of prison re-victimizing people. And I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll because I'm genuinely curious. I struggle with this one. Should Jay Inslee be held personally liable? So, for instance, Jay Inslee granted the early release of Timothy Pauley, a mass murderer. So if Timothy Pauley gets out and Bob Ferguson doesn't change that decision, and he goes and he kills someone else day one or day 500, whatever, hurts somebody else, should you be able to sue Governor Jay Inslee personally to hold him accountable for that? I asked subscribers at Patreon, Locals, and X. Should a governor be held personally liable if they granted clemency or pardoned someone who went on to commit a crime against another person? Yes or no? Nicole?
Well, as much as I would like to answer that with yes, no. I mean, I don't think as a government entity, I mean, obviously you would never pardon anybody with that as a risk, right? Which I don't know. I think there's some people that probably deserve it. And I don't know. It kind of takes away the purpose of the pardon, I guess. It would take away the pardon.
I tend to agree. As much as I really think in the Timothy Pauley case, it's like insane that you would let them out. But for instance, would we want President Trump to be held personally accountable if any of the J6ers he pardoned go on and commit another crime and hurt someone or something, got out of prison early?
Well, it's happened, I think. There's been a couple that have gotten trouble.
Yeah, I mean, people in our poll feel very differently. 80% say yes. 20% say no.
I feel like that's because they have Inslee in the back of their mind right now. But yeah, would you want your enemy to have the same power? I don't know.
Because I do think it would probably say people would just not get pardoned or be given clemency. Right. And look, I mean, maybe that's... maybe we err on the side of caution and say, no, you're just going to serve your original sentence. That's fine. But in the case of the J6ers, for instance, there were some examples of people who'd gotten the absolute book thrown at them for clearly political reasons. Mm-hmm. I didn't agree with all the pardons. So it's a tough one. It's a tough one.
I also think that based on how things work like this in government, it would probably end up being the taxpayers paying any compensation to families of
victims. But that's why I said personally. Could you sue Inslee personally, or would it have to be the state?
I mean, it's an unrealistic expectation, and so I think it would end up being taxpayers. So
yeah, let's see. I'll do a couple from locals. Weiss Castle says, no, where would this end? Would rather limit the governor's power than remove personal immunity. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me see. Wagon Urkel, I don't know. I'd like to say yes, because Governor Inslee was so reckless in his approach, but I need to temper that with what if it happened under more normal circumstances. A governor could release someone with good cause and then have things take an awful turn for the worse. Just because we are elected doesn't make us all knowing. I think the poll results might be skewed because of our well-justified anti-Inslee sentiment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. SLK9, governors should not be able to grant clemency. I think it is always political. Poder, yes, with a caveat if clemency was granted on unfounded grounds. Yeah, and I think though they have the ultimate discretion. I don't really know that there has to be a foundational burden of proof to show that the person's, sentence is no longer in the interest of justice. Mm-hmm. I really think that you can just decide, like, that guy seems nice, pardon. The governor has a lot of power, right? So I think going back to Weiss Castle's comment, I'd rather limit the governor's power than remove personal immunity. So maybe adding more sort of standards to it would be better than just blanket sort of powers. Let's read a couple more. Let's go back to Patreon. Want to move mama? I wish, but it's not logical. This is the same vein as a president not being liable for decisions made in their official capacity that ultimately proved to be poorly made or unpopular. It's a slippery slope. Sharon, I'm not sure about the idea of pardons anyway. Why should the governor be able to arbitrarily release someone and then leave and have no accountability? How do we know he's even looked at into the details of the case or familiarized himself with the circumstances? Here's what I do think would be good. Ban pardons in your final 6 months. No pardons or clemency in your final 6 months.
Yeah, feed to the fire.
For existing cases, mm-hmm. unless the case was sentenced after that period. So you can make some exceptions. But ban pardons in your final 6 months. So you have to at least own the consequences of it. Because mm-hmm. his clemency agreement to release Timothy Pauly, he did it in his final hours.
Final day.
And that's just wrong by any stretch. So maybe I should have made the poll that. Would you support banning the ability to pardon or give clemency in the final 6 months in office?
Yes.
And that may be the difference. Because I think I would support that as well. Unless the case was just adjudicated, so you could make an exception. Unless the case is adjudicated within the final 6 months and you want to make a decision in there. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. Interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, brain teaser for you. All right, how about we do a double dose of unbelievable today, shall we?
Do it.
We just need to make the show 2 hours because we already go long every day anyway. This is just an example. I'm giving a seminar that you can attend, by the way, a free webinar tonight on media literacy. You can find the link on my social platforms. You just got to register, but totally free to attend. And this is the kind of thing I want to talk about on that webinar, because there's like blatant bias, bias in headlines, bias in coverage. But it's like, then there's a different reality. And if you're a person who's not in tune with what's going on, as we talk about a lot, those passive news consumers and passive voters, they'd read something like this and be none the wiser as to the causation. It's like the media fails often to tie like cause and effect. Our homeless crisis is bad. Yeah, but why and who? Our drug crisis, but why and who, right? So the headline of this Seattle Times article seems, straightforward enough. Filling a prescription in the Seattle area, put on comfortable shoes and be ready to wait. So the whole premise of this article, because I'm going to make you guys guess what's missing from it before we even get there. So the whole premise of the article, I'll read some quotes in a second, is that there are very few pharmacies left. So people have to go further to find a pharmacy in a city, right? Can't just like walk down the street like you used to be able to. And that means since there's fewer pharmacies, you have to wait in line for a longer period of time. And I'm sure many of you have experienced that. So specifically when they're talking about the city of Seattle, okay? why do you think is one of the big reasons why there are so few Bartell drugs, for instance? We know. So let's see if the Seattle Times knows, okay? Let's read some excerpts, shall we? Seattle's downtown, which has seen six Bartell drug stores close since 2020, is one of the most noticeable areas in the Seattle area where easy access to a pharmacy has deteriorated. Plagued by broader industry woes, okay, maybe we're getting there. Several drugstore chains, including Rite Aid, owner of Bartell Drugs, CVS, and Walgreens, closed stores across the nation and in Washington. Without easy access to a pharmacy, people are more likely to skip prescriptions and services that are usually only provided by a pharmacist in person, such as vaccinations and counseling on a medication, side effects, and interactions with other medicines. Okay, so they didn't mention the obvious thing there, just kind of referred to broader industry woes. So let's keep going, I guess. I mean, surely, right? Oh, this subhead is titled Seattle Struggles. Okay, now we're going to get to it for sure. Although Seattle downtown and the Chinatown International District were not identified in a UW mapping study as low access areas in 2022, residents have struggled with accessing basic pharmacy services like filling prescriptions after recent closures. The CID lost Bartell Drugs at 4th Avenue South and South Jackson Street in September 2022 and Luke's Pharmacy, the neighborhood's last independent pharmacy, in 2023. Many Chinatown residents now get prescriptions at the International District Community Health Services on 8th Avenue. However, that pharmacy is only open to patients of the clinic. Jeffrey Liang, interim director of the CID Business Improvement Area, said the loss of Luke's was particularly a blow to the area's large Asian community. The pharmacy staff could speak several Asian languages. Mail-in options aren't really a practical option for many of the CID's older adults, he said. Okay, so there's a lot of information there. Still, what is the Seattle struggles? Still missing out on the causation there, right? All right, let's keep going. Margaret Lindahl, 80, said Lindemann Pharmacy on the Virginia Mason Medical Center campus has gotten busy since Buck's Pharmacy on the same campus closed in 2023. Lindahl lives on First Hill in the retirement community Horizon House, a short walk from the pharmacy. She says, sometimes I go over there three times a day and I can't get in line because 30 or 40 people are waiting. Lindahl says her closest alternatives are the Walgreens stores on Pine and Broadway and 3rd and Pike. Both are less than a mile away from Horizon House, but she doesn't feel safe walking there alone, particularly around 3rd and Pike, where there's been reported drug activity. They are surrounded by security, she said. In the store, I feel safe, and that is a viable option for people downtown to get their medication. This is really interesting. So that is the only mention of crime, safety, drug use to explain why this woman doesn't feel comfortable going to a Walgreens that's down on 3rd and Pike. But that's the closest one, and she's got to walk a mile. Nowhere in this article do they talk about the fact that some of these pharmacies have closed because of the crime and drug abuse issue downtown and in places like the Chinatown International District. The absolute rampant street disorder. They chalk it up to broader industry issues. Now, might there be some? Sure, people move into Amazon Pharmacy or whatever it is. That's now where I get my prescriptions. But to act as if the deterioration of public safety in downtown Seattle and elsewhere in Seattle has not led to the closure of these pharmacies is insane. Now, are they lying in this story? No, they're just choosing not to mention it. They are making a conscious choice not to tie cause and effect the increased crime, substance abuse, mental health crises with the inability of these Seattle, probably progressive voters to be able to easily access a pharmacy and medication. That's a choice that the Seattle Times is making. Now, the Seattle Times acknowledges that, hey, you know, she's walking to this Walgreens and she's a little iffy about it because there's some public safety issues out front. Wouldn't it have been easy to say, which is also the reason why this pharmacy and this pharmacy and this pharmacy and this pharmacy said they had to close? The newspaper of record refuses to report on the cause and effect. They report on the bad stuff that happens, but not why. And this is a very long article. It's the reason I read so much of it to you, is I wanted you to know this is a very in-depth article. It wasn't simply like, hey, there are fewer pharmacies in Seattle. Here's a graph. here's what you can do. No, it was a long, in-depth look at the hardship this has created for the elderly and immigrants and people who don't speak English, without saying, because the crime crisis is so bad. That's a choice, remember. It's a choice. It's an unbelievable choice. All right, I want to get to national news, including this whole drama over the Trump administration and its group chat on Signal. First, I've talked about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program for years now, and that's because it's the only weight loss program that has ever worked for me. I've done all the fad diets. I've done all the crash diets. I've had temporary success. This is the only program where I feel like long-term, I've been able to maintain a healthy weight. I started 40 pounds overweight because I put on a bunch of weight during the pandemic, made a decision to check out Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. First 60 days, I lost almost 30 pounds and I dropped 40 pounds on the program total. And like, I've been able to really, for the first time in my entire adult life, maintain a pretty consistent weight ever since. I mean, I'll go up a few pounds there, down a few pounds here, but I always go back to what I learned on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program about what to eat, the right portions. And once I'm able to kind of reset, I can always maintain this healthy weight, which is the first time in my life I've ever experienced that. So this might be the program that you've been waiting for. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Schedule your free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team today. All right, had to talk about this story today. We're just in this place that's so weird to me. I really think this is one of the only communities in this sort of new media space, and I genuinely mean it. I'm not just tooting our own horn, toot-toot. Where I think all of us are capable of independent thought and value independent thought, and we're not like slaves to a party or a movement. And I think it's a unique thing that we all have going on here, where we really value, you know, dissent and the ability to think for ourselves. That doesn't mean I don't have strong opinions, and certainly I align more with Republicans and what Trump is doing right now than Democrats and what's happening in Washington State right now. But it just, the obedience to political party or to political figures is always going to be strange to me. So I'm mortified by some of the reactions to this story. So you probably saw it in The Atlantic, the headline, "The Trump administration accidentally texted me its war plans. U.S. national security leaders included me in a group chat about upcoming military strikes in Yemen. I didn't think it could be real. Then the bombs started falling." So it was written by Jeffrey Goldberg with The Atlantic. And the gist of it is, he's sitting there minding his own business, and all of a sudden he gets looped in on a Signal chat, which, if you're not familiar with Signal, it's like an encrypted messaging service. I sometimes use it to communicate with sources. And it's got the vice president on it. It's got Pete Hegseth on it. It's got members of the national security team on it. And they're talking about these strikes. And they're talking about how they hate Europe and all these things. And they've got Jeffrey Goldstein, who's not a friend of the administration, with The Atlantic, somehow looped in, and they don't even notice that he's there. They're sending all these messages. So there's been a lot of weird reactions to this, but I gotta say, one of the weirdest reactions came from the Secretary of Defense himself, Pete Hegseth, when he was asked about how this reporter was included inadvertently, allegedly, on this Signal thread. Here's his response.
Can you share how your information about war plans against the Houthis in Yemen was shared with a journalist in The Atlantic, and were those details classified?
You're talking about a deceitful and highly discredited so-called journalist who's made a profession of peddling hoaxes time and time again to include the hoaxes of Russia, 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 or the fine people on both sides hoax, or suckers and losers hoax. So this is the guy that peddles in garbage. This is what he does. I would love to comment on the Houthi campaign because of the skill and courage of our troops. I've monitored it very closely from the beginning. And you see, we've been managing 4 years of deferred maintenance under the Trump administration. Our troops, our sailors were getting shot at as targets. Our ships couldn't sail through. And when they did shoot back, it was purely defensively or at shacks in Yemen. President Trump said, no more. We will reestablish deterrence, we will open freedom of navigation, and we will ultimately decimate the Houthis, which is exactly what we're doing as we speak from the beginning, overwhelmingly.
Yeah, didn't ask the question. Deflection, deflection, deflection. You notice what he didn't say, though? He didn't say it didn't happen. He had an opportunity to say that's not true. the Signal chat didn't exist, or it was made up, or Jeffrey Goldstein wasn't on it. But he didn't say any of that, Goldberg rather. But he didn't say any of that. And that's because multiple entities, including the White House and Caroline Leavitt, have since confirmed the authenticity of the Signal chat and the fact that Jeffrey Goldberg was on it. She said in a tweet, Jeffrey Goldberg is well known for his sensationalist spin. Here are the facts about his latest story. No, quote, war plans were discussed. No classified material was sent to the thread. The White House counsel's office has provided guidance on a number of different platforms for President Trump's top officials to communicate as safely and efficiently as possible. As the National Security Council stated, the White House is looking into how Goldberg's number was inadvertently added to the thread. So he was inadvertently added to the thread. And I saw these conspiracies about, oh, they did it intentionally because they were also saying all these bad things about Europe and they wanted Europe to know that they feel taken advantage of. They say those types of things publicly. They don't need to like add a hostile reporter to a thread 2 hours before strikes in Yemen, risking him revealing it publicly just so he leaks bad things they said about Europe. That makes literally no sense. And now Republicans are focusing in on the use of war plans, how Jeffrey Goldberg calls them war plans. And you see them saying they weren't war plans. Here's what Jeffrey Goldberg said on CNN when he was asked about that.
Nobody was texting war plans. Given you were privy to this group chat, is that how you saw it?
No, that's a lie. He was texting war plans. He was texting attack plans. When targets were going to be targeted, how they were going to be targeted, who was at the targets, when the next sequence of attacks were happening. I didn't publish this, and I continue not to publish it because it felt like it was too confidential, too technical, and I worry, honestly, that sharing that kind of information in public could endanger American military personnel.
Which it could, which is exactly why anybody who has the lame excuse that, oh, they included a reporter who, again, has peddled conspiracies in the past, who Pete Hegseth called highly discredited. So that's the guy that they would strategically add to a Signal chat about their plans for a bombing and just what, hope that he wouldn't release those plans before the bombing happened? Someone who they have no trust in whatsoever? Like that excuse does not make literally any sense. And I don't care about, you know, you get into these semantics about, well, they weren't really war plans or it wasn't really classified material. The reality is, in the text, which he, first of all, the only thing Pete Hegseth should have said about that, if he wants to be taken seriously, is we appreciate Jeffrey Goldberg understanding the sensitivity of that information and not releasing it publicly because it could have jeopardized our mission. And that's the truth, is he had information 2 hours ahead of time about bombings the U.S. was going to carry out in Yemen. And he chose and still chooses not to release the details of those plans. They should thank him for that instead of attacking him for it. It's the weirdest, most immature, crazy thing. And as I said about Pete Hegseth, just take the L, dude. Just take the L. Now, I don't agree with the Democrats who are saying people should go to prison for this. No, it's not. It's these crazy responses. The Democrats like, go to prison for this. And Pete Hegseth's like, that reporter's a hack. Dude, you did it. So just take the L. That's the only response is we're looking into how his name was added to that. Obviously, it's unfortunate, and we're very grateful to Jeffrey Goldberg that he didn't release the details of an imminent U.S. bombing in Yemen. And the fact that we can't just arrive at that place, and all these conservatives, again, either downplaying it or finding excuses for it, which I agree, some of the Democratic reactions to it are totally overblown. But would you ever... This is the lens you always got to put it through. Would you ever try to downplay it or found excuses to it if the Obama administration had done the exact same thing? If the Biden administration, rather. If the Biden administration had included a reporter on a Signal group chat about, like, some action they were going to take in the withdrawal from Afghanistan, would any conservative be out there finding excuses and ways to downplay it? Of course not. So it's like, dude, just take the L. Because now it's become this whole thing when you should have just said, well, that was not intentional. Thank you for not reporting it. We're looking into this, reevaluating how we use Signal, whatever it is. And again, the idea that it was done intentionally, that just is asinine to me. So, all right. Meanwhile, in other asinine news, why does this happen so often? Why does this happen so often? Fake hate crimes. Is it because you get so much attention?
I think so.
I mean, even, Oregon? Seems
like an easy, what? What happened in Oregon?
Oregon, in their hate crime bill, you know how we have a hotline, yes. They have a hotline. You can get, like, financial assistance in Oregon if you're the victim of hate crime. So it's just like this incentive for people to manufacture hate crimes. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what happened to a Pennsylvania woman. So she shows up at work one day, and there is a noose on her desk. Very Jussie Smollett. There's a noose on her desk. Yeah, that rings true. I'm sure somebody came into an office where there's plenty of video surveillance and put a noose on your desk. So she's a black woman. Latarsha Brown, 42. So she reports it to police. Well, here's the kicker. She was arrested and charged Monday with making false reports and tampering with or fabricating evidence. Brown, who is also an Allentown school board member, reported finding a noose at her desk on the third floor of City Hall. Officers interviewed all employees who were in the office during that period and requested DNA samples. Captain Steve Milkovich said Monday at a news conference at City Hall that every employee agreed to give a DNA sample except for Miss Brown. Jeez, that's weird. Don't you think if somebody put a noose on her desk, she'd be like, yeah, here's my sample to eliminate me. Nope, every employee agreed except her. So a judge approved a search warrant for police to collect her DNA. Analysis found Brown's DNA profiled match samples obtained from the outer surfaces of the noose and the inner knotted portions of the noose. Brown had emailed her bosses January 9th, the day before the noose was found, to request a mediation meeting to resolve her complaints of discrimination against a coworker. After reporting the noose, she sent another email telling city officials she was at a breaking point. Interesting. So she has a pending meeting about her allegations of discrimination in the workplace. And then, poof, a noose appears on her desk. And of course, police found that quite suspicious, especially considering not only was she refusing to provide her DNA, but when police started asking other employees for their DNA and making those requests, she went back to the police and she told them, just forget the whole thing. Just stop investigating. I'm not interested in pursuing it anymore. They were, and now she's under arrest. Absolutely ridiculous. All right, let's skip that third story, Nicole. We'll get to it tomorrow since we're running a little late today and I want to make sure to get some comments in our closing sanity check, which will absolutely give you no hope for the future of America. First, our friend Zach Abraham at Bulwark Capital, they specialize in managing risk. So if you are, you know, saving for retirement, maybe your retirement's coming up, obviously, and you're concerned about the stock market and what's happening right now, Zach and his team can do a few things for you. So first, they're going to make sure that you understand sort of what's causing the ups and downs in the market. I think it's always good just to be operating based on information because having a period like that when you're getting close to retirement can be a little bit panic inducing. So I think everyone knows that. And the second thing is that they can give you a full reveal of how at Bulwark Capital, they're always looking for opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, and give your retirement as much upside as possible. Zach was telling us the other day that their portfolios are up on the year. So people might be looking at theirs, being like, well, what's wrong with mine? Well, maybe you need a better money manager. Maybe you need someone who's actively managing and mitigating risk. And I think when it comes to your retirement, getting a second opinion is always smart. You'd do it for any other major decision in your life or major purchase in your life or any sort of financial investment. So Zach Abraham and Bulwark Capital can give you that second opinion that you need. So schedule one now and you'll get your free risk review. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. KnowYourRiskRadio.com. And don't miss the latest episode of Doge Watch with Zach tonight. It'll be out. Okay, let's get to comments. Joshua Darling dropped a super chat in at the end of the show yesterday. Permission to purchase public commentary tomorrow morning. State your mind, be active in the fight. They're coming for your rights. Talking about the permit to purchase a firearm. In fact, Daryl Davis was in the chat saying he was signed up to testify against that bill and they just didn't get to him. Convenient. They knew he was one of
us. I'm so bummed. That would have been fun.
That would have been so fun. And he didn't even tell me.
I know.
He didn't tell me he was going to do that. He didn't even ask my advice. That's because he's like, I can do it by myself. I love that. I didn't know Daryl was interested in getting active in Olympia. Good job, buddy. Papa Woody with a $10 super chat. Isn't that the same tactic leftists and socialists appoint judges? point? I don't get it.
I think that you guys talk about the Inslee appointees, just appointing judges. Oliver.
Yeah. Listen, with this, I love the super chats. Thank you. But if I got to read them, you got to make them make sense. I don't know what that means. Isn't that the same tactics? Leftist, socialist appoint. Just tell me what story it's in reference to. Does that mean? No.
Well, it was definitely, it was at the beginning. So yeah. I believe it's the judge. Isn't that the same
tactic? Nancy C, is he going to lose the King County Sheriff's Office deputy's protection? Yes. Dow Constantine, when he leaves office, will no longer have the Sheriff's Office protection.
No protection. Whether
Sound Transit might have some sort of executive protection, but I don't believe it would be the Sheriff's Office.
Yeah, why
no.
would
no? I would be very surprised if it was the sheriff's office. I'll look into it, but I don't believe
He
so.
Can pay for his own. He's getting a big raise.
He's getting $650,000 a year.
You can pay for your own protection.
Pay for your own freaking security. Oh, but he's so used to being driven around.
Mm-hmm.
Stephanie Brushwood, how does Washington State get the federal government's attention? The state is going down the toilet and not all of us can afford to move. And I'm getting tired. I agree. I don't know what else we need to do. Donald, what else do we need to do? I take back everything I said about Pete Hegseth. If you'll help us. I'm just kidding.
All you said is you should take an L, which somebody said, what's an L?
A loss. Take the L, loss. Dude. It just made it worse. Instead, you go on this unhinged rant about this reporter who did you a favor by not by not putting out the nuts and bolts of what you were going to do. You should be thanking him like, hey, dude, thanks.
I think they're just always on the defense.
They are always on the
defense because the media just keeps attacking. But in this case, you should have just been like, sorry.
But you wouldn't believe the number of conservatives who are like, Brandy, this was all a setup, and they're trying to, come on. Because now they're coming up with this excuse that like it was a setup to try to get Pete Hegseth out, and there's bad actors in Trump's national security team who added Jeffrey Goldberg to the Signal chat so that, and I'm just like, would you ever go through that mental gymnastics for Biden? Would you ever? And if that turns out to be the case, then, I guess I'm wrong. Tracy Sachs, so glad I moved to North Idaho. Our gas averages under $2.99 a gallon. Bless you. North Idaho, my dog's from North Idaho. Lucky is from Bonner's Ferry. She was rescued from Bonner's Ferry. B. Larson, as someone who has played hockey for over 50 years, it is probably the most expensive sport for kids to play. Ice time and equipment are very pricey. Why not go for easier and more affordable sports? Not with the taxpayer money. Oh, I get what you're saying. Why not go for easier, more affordable sports? So, like, if you're an immigrant or low-income student, choose a sport that's not as expensive as hockey.
Right.
I think is what he's trying to say. But yeah, and there are plenty of nonprofits. We are overflow with, what are you doing over there?
I have big news. I'm just making sure I Where can break it? It right now.
Where is it?
Well, it's just in my messages.
Okay, well, you just alert me. Do I need to stall?
Well, I'll give you the okay.
Okay, right? And then you're going to put it somewhere in the show sheet, right? Okay.
Sure.
Wow, Nicole. Well, you can take yourself off camera if you got to deal with that.
This is amazing. My heart's racing.
Oh, my God. I think I know what it is.
Yeah.
I think I know what it is.
Hold on. Let me just make sure.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, okay, let me keep reading.
It was just given to me, so I'm pretty sure we're good to go.
Where is it?
Top of the comments.
Wow.
I know.
Breaking news. This is according to the family, right?
Yes.
You're confident in it?
Yep. She said, I'm shaking and crying nonstop.
Governor Bob Ferguson has just overturned former Governor Jay Inslee's decision to release Timothy Pawley. You're hearing it first here on the Undivided podcast. Mass murderer Timothy Pawley, who's been in prison since 1981, accused of killing three people, trying to kill two others at the Barn Door Tavern in SeaTac in 1980. He was granted an early release by the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board in 2022. Governor Inslee stepped in and stopped that early release. And then on his way out of office, Governor Inslee opted to sign his release and rescind his previous blocking of that, allowing a pathway for Timothy Pawley to get out of prison. We know that really the family members of all of Timothy Pawley's victims, but in particular on Sunday's show, we had Kelly and Angie in. Their father was murdered by Timothy Pawley. Their mother was almost killed by Timothy Pawley. They have been very outspoken, calling Jay Inslee a coward for not informing them of his decision on his way out of office to release Timothy Pawley. We are now learning that Governor Bob Ferguson has overturned Governor Inslee's decision, saying that Timothy Pawley will not be granted early release. This was certainly our hope last week when we had Angie and Kelly in. They said that as news of this came out, they got a call from Bob Ferguson's office saying they were reviewing the case. They met with Bob Ferguson personally yesterday, as we discussed exclusively on the show, and Bob Ferguson told them he'd have a decision the next day or two, and his decision has now come down. Nicole, is there any other commentary from the family that you want to read?
Well, right now, Governor Bob Ferguson just tweeted out, after a careful, thorough review of the record, I am issuing an order canceling parole for Timothy Pauley, who is serving a maximum term of life in prison for triple murder he committed early 45 years ago.
Wow. Do you want to get that up? Can you get that up for us? So again, if you're just tuning in, we have this breaking news, a story that we've been covering pretty extensively on the show. Timothy Pauley, and I think in our folder yesterday, we've got some of this content in there if you want to pull it back up. Timothy Pauley, one of the worst mass murderers in our state's history. He killed three people, tried to kill a total of five. For some reason in this state, we have Democrats who have become increasingly obsessed with taking it easy on criminals. And they had been helping and pushing for Timothy Pauley's early release, which in 2016, the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board not only denied his early release, they added time to his sentence. And then you fast forward to 2022, that same board granted his release, and it took an immense public pressure campaign from, Nicole, Dory Monson, the family members of the victims, our friend Ori Hoffman. It took an immense public pressure campaign to get Governor Inslee to deny the board's recommendation. And so it's just been this insane series of events that over the course of less than 3 years, Governor Inslee would go from denying Pauley's release to granting it in his final hours in office. And we had an incredibly emotional interview with Angie and Kelly, whose father was killed by Timothy Pauley, whose mother was nearly killed by Timothy Pauley, who I think were resigned to their belief that Inslee's ruling couldn't be undone. They thought that it was just final. And then they get this call out of the blue from Bob Ferguson's office saying, we're going to give this a second look. And I know my fear last week, and some of you expressed on the show yesterday, that the fear was that Bob Ferguson was giving them false hope. That if he weren't going to reverse this decision or didn't believe he could reverse the decision to release Pauley, then why would he even tell them or reach out to them or tell them he was looking at it? And that's why yesterday I really thought he's going to overturn this thing, because I just didn't think, even Bob Ferguson, as little as I think of him, I didn't believe that he would give the family false hope. So again, Bob Ferguson coming out, he released a full press release, but saying on X just moments ago, we heard it first from the family. After careful, thorough review of the record, I am issuing an order canceling parole for Timothy Pauley, who is serving a maximum term of life in prison for a triple murder he committed nearly 45 years ago. And in it, he includes his order. It is dated today. It says, cancellation of ISRB order of parole. I, Bob Ferguson, governor of the state of Washington, by virtue of the power vested in me by the Constitution and laws of Washington, do hereby order and direct that the order of the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board of the state of Washington in this matter is hereby canceled. The Secretary of the Department of Corrections is ordered not to release Timothy Pauley. The parole granted to Mr. Pauley by the ISRB in the attached order and any prior orders is canceled. That is the right thing for Bob Ferguson to do in this case. I am, and the family, Nicole, if you can characterize what they sent you, they said that, was that Angie or Kelly? They're shaking with.
It was Kelly that was shaking. Angie had just called her and let her know. They didn't have any documents or know anything else other than they had just been told that he was not getting out.
Yeah. And I have this, the order from Governor Inslee is multiple pages, mm-hmm. and I'm curious what his determination was for reversing it. But it's the right thing to do. I'm glad that he did it. And this is really great news for the families of Timothy Pauley's victims.
I do know that when they met with Ferguson, they were told that they cannot give him any new information. So they could make their case based on stuff that they had given Inslee. So Inslee and Ferguson had the exact same information, and Inslee chose to release, and Ferguson said no.
This is what Ferguson said in his order. I'm just going to read from it. So remember, Governor Inslee denied the release in 2022 and then said that, oh, you know, Mr. Pauley has all of a sudden, you know, had to come to Jesus, and he realized what he did was wrong. This is what Bob Ferguson says. Since Governor Inslee's cancellation of his parole in 2022, Mr. Pauley has done additional rehabilitative work and has been articulate in expressing regret and remorse. One must question, however, whether this comes from a place of true remorse rather than self-interest in being paroled. Having considered the ISR board record, I am unconvinced that Mr. Pauley is truly rehabilitated and fit for release at this time. I respectfully disagree with the board and former Governor Inslee and do not find that Mr. Pauley's rehabilitation is complete. Good for you, Bob Ferguson.
Wow.
Oh my gosh, I've got goosebumps,
you
too.
Guys. It's
I knew
crazy.
Something was up with Nicole because she's
that
over there
crazy.
Like frantic on her computer.
Oh, I had dreams about it last night. I went to bed thinking about
goodness.
It, woke up thinking about it. I just had a good feeling today.
Yeah.
But wow.
Yeah, that's amazing. All right, so we'll probably have more on that tomorrow, but that's pretty significant news. We'll get back to comments on the show. Mallory, I refuse to move no matter how bad it gets. Olympia has and always has been my home. Never give up, never stop fighting. Let me see. Gray Matter, BIAW, GOP continue to believe Dems play fair. They're delusional. Washington Supreme Court is captured until they decide to play hardball. This state sinks. Robert Parker, breaking. Eric Crowell, a.k.a. Outraged Pacific Northwest, was served a lawsuit yesterday for misrepresenting himself as the Pierce County Republican Party. Yeah, there's this online Twitter troll, really hates me, and like registered at like something with the state as the Pierce County Republican Party, which he's not. He's just a Twitter troll. And so now apparently he's been served with a lawsuit. Love that. Alice Marie, why can't we learn from bad tax decisions in other states? Like Jackson Hole, Wyoming, people with paid for houses have to move because they were taxed out of them. Inflated property values don't help. I don't want additional gas or sales tax, but at least everybody pays, not just the poor suckers who own property. Yeah, it's just insane stuff. All right, you do have our closing sanity check, right? Amidst all the excitement, let's get to our closing sanity check, shall we? Oh, ladies and gentlemen, if you had any doubt that our nation's education system is failing, I give you this segment from Jesse Waters Show.
Should we eliminate the Department of Education?
No. I've never really had a problem with it.
Education is important.
Don't you feel that the Department of Education has been failing Americans?
No, I don't think so.
Who was the first president of the United States?
Was it Bush?
George Washington.
Who was the second president?
I don't know.
Is it Theodore Roosevelt?
No, babe. That was like 150 years later.
All I know is George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Mr. Donald J. Trump.
Name the three.
Those are the only three he knows.
Only ones he knows.
Oh my gosh. Judicial.
Hold on.
The president. We have Congress.
Hey, at least they look good in the bathing suit.
And Kylie, what's the third?
That's all you need, girls.
Executive. I don't know the third one.
Do you want to put our heads together?
Yeah.
Did that help?
What do you got?
I don't got anything.
How many Supreme Court justices do we have?
Come on.
Two.
Oh, no.
11.
21.
Oh.
50. 46.
Oh.
Eight.
No. Close.
Nine.
Oh, 11. There you go.
No. Name some of the justices.
Genuinely,
you know they
I don't
just
know.
Do this.
Lincoln. Judge
Mintz.
Kamala Harris.
Amy
Schumer.
Justice Brett
Favre.
Bear. Brett Bear.
Not sure how to take that.
Who is the Speaker of the House?
The Speaker of the House?
I don't know. Brain ain't thinking. I'm on the beach.
They just want chicks in bikinis on Fox News. That's the only.
I think you're thinking of someone and you don't want to tell us.
I love her. She's great. She's very young. She's like the youngest Speaker of the House, right?
I think you're talking about Caroline Leavitt.
Yes.
His last name is Johnson.
Magic Johnson.
What is the name of the Secretary of State?
This state? Any state.
Joe Biden.
Ron DeSantis.
Marco Rubio.
Marco.
Polo.
What is 16 times 3?
Wait, you're putting on the spot.
Spell Mississippi.
M-I-S-S-I-P-P-I.
M-I-S-S-I-S-S-I-P-P-I.
Yeah, there you go, girl.
M-I-S-S-I-P-P-I-I.
Mississippi.
This was a disgrace.
A little fun to end the show today. That's, I mean, Fox is genius because get chicks in bathing suits, and then you also get to show how dumb America's children are and how our education system needs an upheaval. You know, there are a couple ones in there that might have stumped me, maybe, but I'll always know how to spell Mississippi. M-I-S-S-I-S-S-I-P-P-I. You know? Redundant. Anyway, that has been your closing sanity check. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We appreciate every single one of you. We sure do. But in particular, we appreciate our subscribers who pay $5 a month or more to support our work. That's awesome. And you know what? You could be one of them. You just sign up right now, right now. Don't delay. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. And you click on the banner in the upper right-hand corner. I think I'm explaining it to you all like children because I just watched that Fox News segment. Click on the banner that says support the show for $5 and that's it. And if you're a member of the military, veteran, or first responder, type in the promo code USA and get 30% off your first year of Undivided. How about that? See you back on the live show tomorrow at noon.